This is episode 58 of The View from Tab. I'm Jim Menick.
I'm John Cruz.
And I'm Chris Palmer.
And we may get Mr. Beats to join us later, and if not, I think our discussion is going to go way past one program, one installment, so we'll get him soon enough, because what we want to talk about tonight is the resolutions, LD resolutions for the 2012-13 season. And I've already talked about these myself on my blog, which people can go look at and disagree with freely, as I know, Chris, you disagreed with me on some of my analyses of some of them. Mm-hmm. And John, I don't know how you felt about them overall.
You actually disagreed with me. I dissented mm-hmm. on two things, as I recall.
Yeah. So what I'd like to do is just take them from the top of the list that as it was posted.
I think that the top of the list is what we dissented strongly on.
We're starting with one of the richer ones. And I want to say, I mean, one of the things when I look at a list or when I look at a Lincoln Douglas resolution, the one thing to me that seems to be important, and this goes back to my just when I started doing this and my roots in the activity, is I like to see an underlying issue, mm-hmm. a true value discussion underlying the resolution, whatever it is. So there's something in there that goes back to some serious core of philosophy or ethics or whatever the case may be. And when I don't see that, it may be because I'm just stupid and didn't see it, but
I don't think that you're stupid. I don't think so at all.
But everybody's periodically stupid.
Yes, yeah, so I have my moments, and I had a few today.
So anyway, let us start then.
So saying that, so that's one of the things I look for, because that'll come up in some of them. But anyhow, the first resolution on the list is resolved. The constitutions of democratic governments ought to include procedures for secession.
And this is one that I violently disagreed with you.
Okay, now both of you disagreed with me on this. So, and just for the record, on a scale of 1 to 10, I gave it a 0.
And I would give it a 10.
So why don't one of you start and explain why you like this? Because I just don't get it.
Well, I'm going to just say one thing briefly, because I think Chris had more developed response than I did. But I think that the key thing, and where I really differ with you, is this is not just about the United States.
Well, I don't say that it is about the United States, but it certainly can't be States.
I'm holding you to what you wrote.
Yeah.
Most of what you wrote was about the United States. And then you claimed that it's just not really an issue outside the United States. But I think it's very much an issue outside the United States. And I think I have to say that the real reason I was very surprised by your response to this is that I think it actually does speak to a pretty core set of Lincoln Douglas classical issues. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you could relate this to the social contract. You could relate to any sort of sense of constitutional or democratic underpinnings of government. At what point are you beholden to your government? And at what point is it okay to declare independence? I mean, it doesn't really get more classical than that in my book. And I think it's actually a very important question. Now, look, I wasn't on the wording committee this year. I have no sense. This is probably why the list was so great. I have no sense of.
Finally, they got rid of you. Yes.
I have no sense of why they picked the topic. I'm sure that the person who proposed it may well be somebody who's like, Texas should be able to secede from the United States. That comes up every so often. It may be that that's what the impetus for this resolution was. But the way it's written, I think it actually speaks to a very important discussions. The two that come to mind immediately are, I think Chris mentioned these actually, are like the Sudan and Ethiopia and like things that have come out from states that have broken away from those countries. It seems to me that that's very much about this. So anyway, Chris had a more developed thing.
Yeah, the general tension I think here is between the potential survival of the state, because if a state writes into its own constitution the ability to dismember the state, then there's a question about how viable can that state be to begin with. If you prompt into your constitution the ability to leave just because you don't like something, then it's possible that the state is actually just setting up its own suicide and can't survive at all. But on the other hand, you have the potential for a group or subgroup within the state to want to leave and being left with no legal option to do so. And there are various reasons why a subgroup might want to. They might be an ethnic or religious minority that's concentrated in a particular area of the country. And absent any legal method of leaving and any automatic method of leaving in the constitution of the country, they have to fight a war, right? And civil wars tend to be the bloodiest and most awful wars in our country. I mean, in any country, you talk about even the American Civil War is by far the bloodiest war in American history. We lost many, many more people in the Civil War than we did in either of the World Wars. And so you basically have this tension between the state and the ability and the power of the state and the ability of groups within the state to self-determine. Now, added on top of that is the fact that those groups within the state are very poorly defined. One of the things I took exception with in your post is you said that the definition of a nation is clear-cut. That's completely false. Mm-hmm. The definition of a state is clear-cut. The definition of a nation is probably one of the most ambiguous concepts in, you know, this field.
I didn't say that. I said something different, but go ahead.
So, I'm going to have to quote
you. Now you said the point of nationness
is that it is absolute.
And that's not true at all.
I'm not saying the nations are clearly defined. I'm saying that nationness is absolute.
How can it be absolute if the nation isn't clearly defined, though? You can belong to more than one nation, right?
That doesn't mean that the nations aren't clearly defined. It means that I, as an individual, may have multiple allegiances.
But yeah, that, I think that undermines what does that mean? The point of nationness.
What does absolute mean, then?
I mean, part of what my thought
is... I kind of want to say we're not trying to debate you, but we are debating you.
Yeah, no.
So.
Definitely. First of all, I wasn't saying that, I thought it should be applied to the U.S. I was saying that, in fact, I mean, to me, the U.S., obviously most of my experience in historical study is on the U.S. So the U.S. informs my thinking. Now, the U.S., essentially set up a union that is unbreakable for whatever reason. It brings up an unbreakable, it's set up to be unbreakable. It does not, it doesn't have, a prenup part to it. You know, it's like, this is it. You can't break this and breaking it is illegal, mm-hmm. And so, and everything that we've done in this country, the Civil War, everything about union, the meaning of union, is to me the import of what union is all about. So, that is an argument in favor of saying, no, you shouldn't have these procedures, presumably. Because if you do have these procedures, we don't have the union. The union is worth nothing. So how can I... I'm a staunch unionist.
Though?
I mean, I...
That's what the United States has done, but is that necessarily an argument that it should be so?
Right. I mean, think about it this way.
I buy the logic that informs that decision having been made. So I'm not just saying we should do it.
Yeah, but even the Civil War couldn't 100% settle this. The Supreme Court actually heard a case about Texas seceding a few years after, where they tried to, I guess, give additional, legitimacy to what Lincoln's government did. And I think that's actually worth noting, because that shows that even after the Civil War, people are still like, the Constitution doesn't really directly say you can't secede.
Yeah, it has no explicit.
There's nothing explicit in the Constitution that says it. So the Supreme Court actually, everyone knew it was sort of like a test case, right? Like everyone knew that the Supreme Court was just going to say, we just had a civil war that resolved this issue. But they actually had a case to talk about this because they felt like they just still needed more legitimacy to that argument. So
still 150 years ago. And if Texas decides to secede now, do we let them do it? Of course not.
Well, our Constitution doesn't have that provision.
Yeah,
but if they really wanted to, of course not.
But how do you build a federal government? How do you build a government? I mean, I'm thinking now, everything that went into building our federal government and the meaning of having that federal government and for that government to get recognition by other nations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How do you build that nation that's a real nation, it's a real political entity, if it's fluid? If, these guys are going to be out next week. Or, here's our government and it's really good today. I don't know about tomorrow. To me, a nation is defined as something that other things that we've already defined as nations say, you're a nation.
Yeah, that's fuzzy, though, because, tell that to the Kurds.
Yeah.
Right.
should the Kurds then therefore just take it in the chin and suck it up and get bombed right, or all the time?
Or all like the clients to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Ottoman Empire. I mean, I'm yes, those weren't democracies. I understand, but like that, but I still think that there's a central issue here. Well, when it was the Ottoman Empire,
right? Like,
okay. Just like his historical examples. Like, I just think this is such a rich topic. I'm actually shocked that you hate it so much. It seems such a self-evidently good topic to me, because
I'm sitting now in the Constitutional Convention of X.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And who is in this? Who comprises the people that are in this? You know, we want to have this nation, X land.
Well,
who,
here's the thing, though. No. It? You keep using the word nation, but that's not what nation means.
Right.
It's nation state. Is not the group of people governed by a particular government. Nation is bound up into ethnic identity, linguistic identity, religious identity. It has a lot of components that have nothing to do with who your government is at any given time.
I mean, you're going to define nation. It says government here. It doesn't say nation. I mean, I'm forgetting. It says democratic government. We're talking about government. So government is government. Okay,
but nation is not government.
And that's why people use terms like
nation state and things like that.
I mean, you can have a situation where there's
a Cherokee nation. Okay.
Right. Well, exactly. That's important. That's an important distinction.
Or
right?
you could be on the wrong side of a border. I mean, the people in Alsace and Lorraine before 1918 would have said that they're part of the French nation, even though they were ruled by the German government.
Right. Or I think that a great example of this is so many of the African countries whose borders are just European colonial borders, and that's why there's so much. I mean, it's one of the many reasons, but it's a major, if not the major reason why there is so much strife in these countries, because these boundaries reflect nothing.
So we're in one of those countries now. We're trying to build a government.
Yep.
Okay. So are you saying that we have all these rival groups, or not necessarily competing or rivals, but just disparate groups? We have all these disparate groups, and they are coming. I'm really asking this to come to an understanding. So they're making, and they're all together now and say, okay, we are going to form a government.
Yep.
Well, we all have special interests.
Not really.
Let me interrupt for one second.
The borders were imposed on them because they were just heritage of the
border. I'm talking about these are the people. I don't care about what their borders are. These are the people who are going to be part of the government.
Let's just be very clear about something. And this sort of speaks to your initial dislike of this topic. We should be clear. There is no context to this resolution, except that it's a democratic government. And that is important. I think that is important. But yes, and the thing that I think that both Chris and I are thinking of, that you're correct. But anyway, go on. I'm sorry.
Anyhow, I mean, I'm assuming I'm starting a constitution, or you know, as compared to amending a constitution. But probably six and a half dozen another. But let's say I'm starting a constitution. So I have six groups, let's say, represented in here, and we've all come together to form this democratic government.
Okay. Now, the important thing to notice is those six groups were not self-selected.
They're
not there by their own choice. In any African nation, the groups were put together by people other than themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, why are they a part of this then?
Because the lines on a map that France and Britain drew happened to include them and not include others. That's the entire reason why the map of Africa looks like it is.
And you can even think of it as. I mean, I don't know if this would technically be secession, because I don't know if Slovakia seceded, but another example that comes to mind is Czechoslovakia, which is like totally artificial grouping of people that Woodrow Wilson, this is like your Slavs, that's grouping
or
together.
Yugoslavia, for that matter.
Or Yugoslavia is that's a really good example as well, right? Yeah. Like these sort of like arbitrary borders.
Well, how did the former Yugoslavia become what it is now? Well,
through wrenching civil war in many
cases. Exactly. So that's actually why this is a compelling topic, because think about all these cases of secession, violence. So the question is, is the violence worth it?
It wasn't a democracy.
Well, it was heading that way once communism fell.
Right.
But it decided to become a democracy, not altogether. And
you're right.
And the better example would be Kosovo, because Serbia is nominally a democracy, but did not let the Kosovars secede.
Right. Or the Basques in Spain, I'm sure, would say that they should be able to secede.
But if we go back to Africa, there's actually a great example in Ethiopia.
Yes.
Ethiopia's constitution contains the provision for secession. It defines the constituent nations of the Ethiopian Empire within itself. And these are distinct ethnic groups that have linguistic differences and whatnot. The basic unifying principle of all Ethiopia is, I think, for the most part, all their groups are Christian. But any of the nations can choose to secede through a mechanism defined in the constitution, and one has, which is Eritrea. And Eritrea became its own independent country through this process, and not a shot was fired, and it was a relatively peaceable and harmless separation, right, as it were. What's happened since then, you can argue about. But A, no other group has seceded from Ethiopia. B, one of the effects of this has been that the minority nations have not been treated so poorly by the majority as has happened in other countries. Because if the minorities can all leave, if they get treated poorly, there's less incentive for the majority group to, you know, kick the crap out of them and exploit them. And, you know, Ethiopia is just chugging along just fine. You know, it's still a government, still unified. It's missing part of what it had before. But, you know, why is that a problem?
This...
The other sort of relevant thing to look at...
It's different in every single instance.
Well, that's the point. And there's an AF argument or an EG argument, right? It isn't appropriate for all governments.
The assumption here is all governments. I mean, the way that this is worded,
right, which is why that's an EG argument. So, yeah. On the other hand, you have situations like Belgium, where Belgium was very much a unified nation in a lot of cultural respects at the turn of the century, World War I, etc. And the unifying principle in Belgium was Catholicism, and they were the portion of the Dutch people who became the Flemish people who were Catholic. As opposed to the Protestants who lived in Holland, and then the French Southerners were also Catholic.
Right,
that's why they were Belgium, and that's why they felt to be one nation. But as the influence of religion has declined in Europe, that is no longer a unifying principle in the countries
apart. And there are a lot of people who want to secede there. I mean,
right.
That's like
the
country is going to disintegrate.
Yeah, the country will split in half in our lifetimes unless something radically changes. It took them 3 years to put together a government because nobody could stand to cooperate with somebody on the other side of the language divide. And so you have an instance where what used to be the unifying principle was religion, and now the disunifying principle is language because religion doesn't hold as much sway.
I mean, having visited there 20 years ago, it is the most schizophrenic country ever.
It is.
Because you go to the store and you buy something, and it would ring it up, and then it would be in French. And the next person, they would ring it up, and it would be in Flemish. And the next person would be in French. And then it would be back and forth. What do you think? These crazy people, pick one.
Apparently, the convention is that everybody speaks both languages.
Right.
And so you speak always your own language, because it is assumed that everybody will understand you. So you'll have conversations where one person's speaking in French and the other one speaking in Dutch, because everybody understands everything. So.
Yeah. No, I actually had a friend who was Belgian, and she would talk to her mother in three languages in the same sentence. And it was the most amazing thing I'd ever heard.
I had a very close friend who's Belgian, and all he did was insult the Flemish people. So there you go.
There you are, right?
If you have a government, presumably the Belgium government has no provisions for this. So is this resolution saying that that they should change their constitution?
I mean, because the difference would be you have a violent civil war, you have a non-functioning government, which I guess is the Belgian.
If you're asking if you're saying the resolution is should we have a civil war or should we do this peaceably? Yeah, okay, fine, let's do it peaceably.
Well, do it peaceably.
That's not great. That's not particularly arguable.
I think it's do it peaceably or do it with difficulty, right? Like, should the government be putting roadblocks between constituent groups leaving or not? And the argument that they shouldn't has a lot of points, but I think what you were saying is that there's no argument why they should, and I don't think that's true. I think there are plenty of arguments why they should do so. Right? It'd be a terrible resolution if it weren't, if it were obviously true that they should do so, or obviously false that they should. But, the fact that there's ambiguity there is what makes it a debate resolution.
And so all the debaters are going to pick a country, preferably over the space of a couple of months, a lot of countries, so they can keep changing it. And, like, I'll have a country for the prelims and another country for the elims and all this kind of stuff. Nobody's going to know what anyone else is talking about, especially the judges.
The list isn't that long.
And I don't know what... Well, yeah.
I mean, I suppose you could run a plan, but there does seem to be an affirmative.
I mean, people will run plans on this.
Yeah, but there does seem to be an implicit affirmative burden that you do need to defend the general case that this is a good idea across the board. And you know what? The number of countries that are engaged in active secession, you can rattle them off. It's not that hard. And there are a lot of examples.
How many aren't? And how many would be?
Most
aren't. And if most could be, because there is some underlying reason why we should do this. Again, here's my thing. What is the underlying reason so that we don't have a civil war if there's a problem?
Well, and more to the point, it protects minority groups.
Protection of minority groups.
Ever since Quebec started agitating for independence, the Quebec province has received a ton of federal largesse from Canada because Canada doesn't want them to leave.
Right.
And so the French-speaking minority in Canada has gone from being the scum of the earth, as far as the federal government is concerned, to being put into a privileged position as a result of the sovereigntist movement. And
could they
know full well
it?
That if they went back to treating the French as an economic underclass the way they had been for a good century in Canada's history, that the country would fall apart. And so that protects the minority.
Could Quebec leave? I mean, can they?
That's completely unclear. It's the
right.
Canada is a constitutional mess to like that is astounding. They're not. It's not even clear they have a constitution.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, England.
Well, no, it's even worse than England. Much worse. Like England has an implicit constitution, not an explicit one. It's not clear that Canada even has that, because they, for a while, their constitution was an act of British Parliament.
Right.
And at one point, they wanted to bring it back into Canada, basically, and not have to go to the British Parliament to change their own constitution, goddammit. And so they did so, and they tried to rewrite it and did something called the Meech Lake Accords. And the result of the Meech Lake Accords was actually the sparking of the sovereigntist movement in Quebec, because Quebec wanted protections for French language and culture, and the rest of the provinces weren't willing to give it. And so Quebec never signed on to the constitution. And it is strongly implied, but not very clearly so, that all the provinces in Canada had to sign on to a constitution to make it viable. So the Quebecois theory is that there is no constitution right now. And the rest of Canada is more or less going along with this idea that there is one. But if push ever came to shove, it's not at all clear what would happen and how. And the whole country could unravel. Because if Quebec left, the supposition is that the far west provinces would leave as well. And so you'd end up with three Canadas, not two.
One's more than enough.
Yeah, you know. So there you go.
And I read this book, Ratification, by Pauline Meyer, who I really like. And, I mean, the whole thing, we had a constitution. And then all of a sudden they have this constitutional that is essentially an unbreakable deal. And then they have this other convention gets together and they come up with a constitution, and this is like so unclear what's going to happen. Then of course our constitution, which we finally adapted, only needed 9 states, and the others were forced to, even though some states didn't sign on to it. There was one that signed on like 20 years ago.
Rhode Island took forever for some reason.
The rules implicit in this constitutional convention that may not have been legal according to the constitution under which they were operating at the time, blah blah blah. I mean, right. This is
and they think that the constitution itself didn't apply to a given state until that state ratified it, and until the state did, what did apply to them, God only knows. And there was also a movement soon after the Constitution, and Aaron Burr was wrapped up in this, where the New England was strongly federalist, which meant for a stronger central government, whereas the rest of the country went pretty strongly Democratic-Republican, which is Jefferson, which is very agrarian, salt of the earth, do your own thing, and the government stays out of the way, mostly because New England wanted there to be a stronger navy to protect their merchants and fishing, and that wasn't compatible with Jeffersonianism. And at one point, somebody said, well, why doesn't New England just secede? And the country was so young, and everybody was just kind of like, yeah, well, that's not the worst idea. Okay. You know, it did not nearly inspire the kind of rage and difficulty that the Civil War did. It was just kind of floated out there, and people were like, huh, well, we could do that. You know, like, that's at that level it was taken at the time. So if that had happened, you wouldn't have had a Civil War, because there would have been a precedent.
Yeah, it's... I don't know if I want to go into this in a debate round. I'm not
that necessarily. Why? I mean, I just don't.
We just managed to talk about it for half an hour. Don't you think kids could talk about it for a semester?
I guess I just really don't get it. Like, this seems to me like an awesome political theory, philosophical topic. I mean, honestly, Jim, I'm surprised because I just feel like it really gets the heart of so many issues that, frankly, LD has not been doing a good job talking about lately. I'm kind of excited by this topic.
Fungible government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What does that mean? It's strange that you don't want to debate this topic when right now you're debating this topic.
Jim, I'm honestly
a fascinating conversation about this topic, mm-hmm. which to me says we should debate this topic.
Okay, well, what is the
I expected you to blow up about? I will say this. From a purely U.S. perspective, given the kinds of people who advocate,
you couldn't argue. This is not about the U.S. I mean, it's clearly
not
about
the U.S. I know, but it seems to me that Let me finish my psychoanalysis here, please. Okay,
it's not about the U.S. So we forget the U.S.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to say is, if we go back to your initial objection, which I still think is forming the basis for why you hate this topic, I think that inside your gut, you know what I mean. Your gut take on this is the kinds of debates you would have are like Tea Party debates. I mean, objection was.
No, my original – first of all, I said in my thing – what I meant in my thing, which obviously was unclear, was that you couldn't argue this about the U.S. So the U.S. was out of the picture.
I mean, I actually think it is an interesting debate to have about the U.S. I'm just going to be real about
that.
You know, I could make the joke about I wish certain states would secede, but that's not even really the point. I mean, I actually think it is fascinating that we've just decided you can't secede in the United States. Yes, we fought a war over it. I get all that, but like it is kind of fascinating
that slavery and the slave system, and so there's a lot of external baggage there.
That's right. Yeah. But as a principle, it's actually fascinating to me that this country has decided that states cannot secede, especially given the federal nature of our government. You know, we give so much respect to the individual states. You know, this is not like – well, Spain is actually a bad example. It's not like a lot of European countries where the provinces are just, you know, are nothing. They're just extensions of the national government.
France is very much like that.
Yeah. The department. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that that we've just sort of consented to this idea that the states cannot secede. I mean, think about how the founders wrote the term the United States. They wrote it as a plural. And it indicates to me that if you had really interviewed some of the founding fathers, I bet they would have been in favor of secession, right? Yeah. I mean, they were long dead by the Civil War. They talked about it
for New England.
Right.
They thought it was a fine idea if that's the way it happened to have to happen. Yeah.
So I actually think it's a real
– The states are not the signatories to the Constitution. The people are the signatories to the Constitution.
That's not true.
They're representing states.
They're representing to the states.
As originally conceived, it was totally the states that did it. It was
not the states did the ratification, but the words themselves don't say.
But what does that mean?
Then why are they called states and not provinces?
Right, and not only that, why
they call whatever they want to call themselves.
Wait a minute,
what is Massachusetts called?
State is a very significant word, and that implies sovereignty.
And you needed a specific number of states for the Constitution to go into effect. So I would argue that shows that in fact they did see it as the states signing on. I would argue
that the United States now is one country as much as France, for all practical purposes, and there is no different cultural difference between take California and Alabama.
Well, I disagree about that.
No significant cultural difference that says these should be different countries.
Well, then, if you had a provision for secession in the Constitution, it wouldn't get executed, right? If there are no significant cultural differences that people felt the need to separate, then they wouldn't use it. Insignificant ones,
and they would do it.
Why would they? Then why hasn't Ethiopia fallen apart when there's much, much greater cultural significant differences?
Maybe they're smarter than we are. I see our politicians all the time, and these idiots would be seceding right and left if they had the chance to do it.
You're going to have a hard time making that case in a debate round. I don't think I buy that at all.
Let me see. Which states do you think? Texas? Are you thinking Texas would – if Texas could and the governments that Texas is the state governments that the Republic of Texas has had, that they would still be part of this government? I don't know.
Why hasn't Quebec seceded from Canada? Why did they not?
Because they speak French.
Yeah, why have they not seceded?
Because they, who knows what people who speak French.
Well, one of the big reasons is they get about $10 billion more coming in than they pay out in taxes, and Texas is much the same. If they looked at those numbers, would they say, maybe we should stay?
So we got to bribe people because otherwise they're going to leave.
Well, no, more to the point, if you look at it globally, what you have to do is not treat minorities like they're shit under your shoes, which just happens to a lot of ethnic minorities within the wrong borders.
But are these minorities now, I mean, let's go back to Ethiopia. I don't know anything about Ethiopia, mm-hmm. really. So are these minorities like geographically together? So like, you know, the so-and-sos
much, yeah.
are living here and the so-and-sos are living there. So they are, in fact, like blocks on risk, and you can move them and just redraw the different color and they'd be part of another country, or they could be a unique country or something like that easily enough. They're not a minority spread out like African Americans in the U.S.
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Because, I mean, and, you know, I mean, if it's just an accident of where they happen to land, yeah, I can see that. I'll agree with that as being a meaningless distinction and not as meaningful as having the protection of government against your people.
You know, well, so. And who's going to protect you against government, right? Yeah,
so.
I mean, South Sudan is an excellent example.
All right, so we've by arguing about this for, let me see, 32 minutes, we've demonstrated that you can't argue.
Indeed.
About this one.
Right. Well, more to the point, in sort of a wider pedagogical thing, I think this is a topic that many people will have a similar knee-jerk reaction as you did, which is to say, good God, we fought the Civil War, and it was obviously bad. But the reason why the Civil War was secession around the Civil War was obviously bad is because of why it was done.
Right, that's right.
Not because of what it was, right? The secession to support a system of slavery based on racial grounds is abhorrent. But that doesn't – the key word in that sentence is not secession. And so the question that this will expose students to is a global context of racial minorities and what constitutes a nation and whatnot, and how nations are formed is really fascinating. Nationalism theory is something everybody should be exposed to. And then how can a government, you know, interact with that? And how do you check the government? That's the question here. And getting a lot of teenagers past the whole Civil War, rah, 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 bad level to learn that layer of this analysis, I think, is the purpose of this topic.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I may not have been clear, but I would never want to argue about the U.S. if I were arguing this. I would be arguing about something else altogether. So on that, in that respect, you're right. I mean, it will force people to learn a lot of stuff about other countries and nationalism and stuff that, you know, is good. And, you know, it's just, we'll see. I mean, you know, a lot of what you're saying gives me some information now that I don't have at the top of my head because I'm not big. I don't know this stuff.
Yeah, and I know this stuff pretty well, which is part of why I like it. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, and that always is a good thing. Forcing people to learn something they don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, as long as there's enough structure and the people are roughly doing the same thing, so that we're going to talk about Africa as the real theater for this, for the most part, or the former Yugoslavia, or something like that. You know, there's some really good examples of what could happen, what should happen.
In their breakaway Chechnya, those kinds of things, I think.
Russia would not be the first country I would want to discuss as a democracy.
I agree, but I think that there's literature.
Chechen shared would. And then also you've got the situation in Georgia with South Ossetia and North Ossetia, and there's breakaway republics there. I mean, there's a lot of meat there, too.
But it's such
there's a large Russian minority in Ukraine.
I don't think Chechnya is obscure. Chechnya? That actually comes to me immediately.
No, the Georgian War is obscure.
Yeah. I think that those are obvious places. And actually, I think that they're very fair topic. Like that those are things kids should know.
Completely topical. Because this also gets into the nature of it also gets into the nature of democracy too,
right?
Because you could start saying, "Well, Russia's not truly a democracy." I don't think. I think this would be a great Jan Fub topic for that.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, I can't see. Let's put it this way: it can't be anything else but a Jan Fub topic.
I don't know.
The way the voting's gone lately, it could be whatever it wants to be lately.
yeah, there is that. But I mean, to get the kind of good discussions that you guys are talking about these places. You're not going to get that in the first month of a topic, and not going to get it in September, you know,
or anything
like that.
I think if it ended up being anything but Jan Feb, it would finish leaving kids wanting more. I think that's true.
by the end of the 2 months, people would finally have gotten the language down, and they would understand these various countries to some extent and know which ones to do. I mean, if you don't know anything about this stuff, you got like, you know, 200 countries to start with. Which one do I start
with? I don't think it would take that long to shake out. I think it would be
a
quicker shakeout process than that. But I do agree that by the end of a topic, if this were like November, December, I think we'd be wanting more. I think
this is also a topic that lends itself to a school that has a machine to do a lot of research and the one learning kid kind of thing.
I don't agree about this.
I don't think so.
I'm actually surprised to say that. I think that this – you want me to tell you what I think this topic lends itself to? To a kid who actually reads a book about political theory and understands what the nature of the state is. I actually strongly disagree with that statement. I think this is Yeah, I really do. I really do. Because I think, yes, you could have the body count about the specific wars, but the actual truth is there aren't that many countries on Earth where this is a serious pressing issue. Chris mentioned that before.
Okay,
so I don't think that there's a massive research burden on this. When I looked at this topic, I'll actually tell you.
Well, if it's only true for three countries, then I would argue against it on the basis of that.
It's not,
well, no,
it's
more like 20, but the point is that the benefit of a generic position falls to the negative.
That's right. And
the affirmative can write all the plans they want about 23 countries, but the negative, the same negative is going to respond to all 23 of those plans.
And I just want to say that a real gut reaction, I should have said this from the start, but what you just said made me think of this again. Honestly, one of my very first reactions to reading this topic was, wow, I wish I could have debated that in high school.
Yeah.
And I debated it at a small team. I had no formal coaching, and I know that huge, you know, political history nerd John Cruz, who still is a political history nerd, but especially at that age, would have just eaten this topic up. And I think it's a cool topic for that reason. I think this topic rewards kids who read. And I like that. I think that's a good thing for debate to encourage. That's just that, but I do. It's my opinion, but I strongly feel that. I just disagree that this is a machine type of resolution. I don't think it is.
Okay.
You know.
I mean, that may be the reaction of someone who doesn't have a machine. Yeah. So.
Well, fair, but I just.
What is the policy topic next year?
Transportation infrastructure.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with it whatsoever.
Nothing
to do with it.
And
they're not even going to other countries.
And what was this year? Space, right?
So space.
The final
was an awesome topic. Mm-hmm. But
There's not like a lot of stuff sitting around.
No,
just co-op.
This is a topic. You know what? Yeah. You know what I say, Bronx Science. I'm going to say to the kids, if this is their topic. Here are three books to read about political theory. And to me, that's just what this is. This is a cool. I just can't wrap my head around it because I keep thinking.
I think the kid who goes up there and knows everything there is to know about Chechnya is going to lose a lot of debate rounds. And the kid who goes up there and knows everything there is to know about constitutional theory is going to beat that kid who knows everything about Chechnya. And the machine will be helped for the kinds of topics where you need to know everything about Chechnya and Pakistan and Sri Lanka. But this isn't that real. This is not that topic. This topic means you have to read about nationalism and constitutional theory.
Yeah.
Recommend books?
I have a few, yeah. Nationalism, you should read Benedict Anderson's Imagine Communities and Gellner, which is
very good.
Yeah, Imagine Communities is excellent, and Gellner's Nations and Nationalism is also very good. Michael Ignatieff has a great book called Blood and Belonging about nationalism, and he was the leader of the opposition in Canada for a while there. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there. And then Lawrence Lessig has written a lot about constitutional and constitutional theory. He advised a number of former Soviet countries.
Why do I know that guy?
He does a lot about online advocacy as well. He's a law professor at Stanford. He was one of the founding members of the Berkman Center for Law and Society at Harvard. And he does a lot of internet law and society, I think. But he does a lot of internet stuff too. But he's expert in constitutional theory. He's a good guy to read about these topics. Mm-hmm. So,
good.
That's just off the top of my head. I'm sure there's more.
Good. We can do one more.
Yeah, we probably can do two. I don't think we're going to actually.
I don't know.
Take as much time.
How long has this episode been? I can't tell when we started recording because I actually thought that was a pretty complete.
We started
discussion.
At 20. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we're like into about. I can tell you because I can take a look at the thing. We did about 40 minutes. The second one, resolved. When making admissions decisions, public colleges and universities in the United States ought to favor members of historically disadvantaged groups.
Hmm.
I mean, I found this one okay.
Yeah, that's about my reaction.
Mm-hmm. My reaction to this is that it's an interesting way to approach the should affirmative action be about race or about economics, but my immediate reaction to it is by not picking one of those two terms, I feel like that makes for an odd debate, because I guess you could very easily argue that poor people have been historically disadvantaged, as have the racial minorities. So rather than flesh out that debate and just put them head to head or do whatever else you would do with affirmative action, it just, I don't know, I guess it'd be, you'd be debating a lot of definitions in this.
And yeah. This one I think of as your pick your plan kind of resolution.
Right. That's right.
You know?
In other words, you're saying that we could support historically disadvantaged white trash.
Right. Or right. left-handed Namibians.
Here's a very specific disadvantaged group. Right. That's exactly.
Let's say, racial.
Well, especially because there is a real public debate over should affirmative action be about economics as opposed to race? And I think that there are good arguments, frankly, on both sides.
But historically disadvantaged, to me, not going to necessarily say poor.
I agree, except if enough runs, the debate universe will run that. Right, yeah, exactly. Mm. You could say that they are, in fact, historically disadvantaged. The poor have been historically disadvantaged.
I'm going to have a hard time voting on topicality if somebody says poor people are historically disadvantaged, you know? So,
But poor people... I think you can come up with some arguments like the day you're not poor, then you won't be disadvantaged anymore. But, if I win the lottery,
I guess.
You're not going to win the white lottery.
Then you're not part of the case.
Or you say that children of poor people have been historically disadvantaged.
That's probably
how it would actually be phrased in the
And that also what
we really wanted to say. Go ahead.
Could also be a counterplan too, because you can argue that most of the racial discrimination is captured by economic discrimination, and there have been arguments to that effect. I don't know that it's true, but it's out there. The literature is out there.
But the point is not that you're being disadvantaged, but that some group of which you are a member was disadvantaged. That disadvantage still holds just because you're a member of that group,
You're the first person in your family to go to college.
Yes.
So your family has been historically disadvantaged.
There has to be more to it than the fact that they were just like dumb people that didn't get to college. It would have to be because they were poor.
What you argue is that social mobility in this country is low, and therefore being born poor means it's highly likely you'll end up poor no matter what your ability is.
Why would you argue that if you could argue race? I don't know.
Because you don't want to argue race.
You don't want to argue. Some people say, why should you get the if you've grown up? I mean, this is the argument, right? Isn't this the argument against affirmative action as practice? That some people say, if you are an affluent minority family and you've had all the benefits, that come with that, then doesn't that negate supposedly the disadvantage that comes with the historical stigma that has been attached to your race? That's the argument against affirmative action, right? I mean, that's the strongest PC argument against affirmative action that people make.
But if you run poverty as your disadvantaged group, then you avoid everybody's race blocks. That's
right.
Really
that's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I kind of think of this as tricky.
I agree.
For that reason, it's not a bad literature to wade into, but I really hope it's not Jan Feb, which of course means it probably will be. But
my first reaction to this was it was narrow. I mean, there isn't a lot to argue.
Like, if this was a March, April, or an NFL's topic, that would be fine because it's a good idea. Kids, a lot of our debaters are wealthy little white kids who don't know what a minority is, and so it can't hurt them to expose them to this kind of literature and understand the arguments for. There are a number of kids, I think, who, despite being your typical suburban white liberal, do reflexively think, oh, well, affirmative action is just totally unfair because they view it as impinging onto their universe. The big thing they're afraid of is they won't get into college. And if somebody gets into college ahead of them, well, that's terrible. Mm-hmm. And so it can't hurt to expose those kids to the reasoning why behind, affirmative action and force them to argue that. But at the end of the day, I don't really want to be judging this for 4 months either.
Yeah, it's a one-trick pony. I mean, you want to do it at Nat-Nats or Cat-Nats or something like that, or districts, and never have to do it again.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I can see that as That's fine. Probably be okay as a September, October. I don't know.
Well, no, maybe not even. September, October is an awfully dense. It's an awfully dense topic.
Yep.
Area.
And it's the tone setter for the year. I don't know how.
Yeah.
I
feel. Yeah, well, that's true. Okay. We can get one more in.
Sure.
One more, because I think we'll probably agree.
This one's a quick one, too. Yeah.
Resolved. The United States Supreme Court justices should be subject to term limits. I think they should be subject to physical.
I think it's actually a fascinating topic. There was an interesting thing in the New Yorker, I think, about this not too long ago.
Yeah, there was. I mentioned that in my thing.
Yeah,
it was a good article.
I teach AP U.S. government. We actually had a big discussion about this, about the idea of like staggered term limits for the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. There's actually not an enormous amount of literature on this, but there is very rich literature on this. I think it's a fascinating topic. The only thing I have that I'm fearful about this topic is that it will get repetitive very quickly. That's my only fear.
I think you're probably right about that.
I think it's a fascinating topic, though, and I had been on the wording committee this year. I'm very confident I would have supported this, but I can see how this would become limited. Is my
only fear. It's a very precise area.
Right, exactly.
There's not a lot of scope there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think
it asks a very important but very particular question.
Yeah, I think it's
actually
good for
teaching. I have to be honest with you. I don't want to, and this is not meant to be disparaging in any way, but this actually to me sounds like an extemporaneous speaking question. It sounds like a question you draw an extemp and you're going to give a 7-minute speech about, or somebody's going to write an oratory about this. I just don't see this being a 2-month topic, even though it's such a good one. This is actually an objection that some people had to a topic that I wrote actually and pushed for, and it didn't get selected in the end, and it only very narrowly made the top 10 list last year, which was the estate tax topic, because I maintain I appreciate that. I maintain that and the topic that we'll talk about in another podcast relates to the post office. In my opinion, those are two of the most pressing and fascinating philosophical political debates that we have today, but I kind of acknowledge in the end, I mean, the state tax, I still believe, could have been debated for 2 months, but I do acknowledge that those kinds of precise topics are difficult. That's true. I guess it could be the September topic, October topic, but I think
the thing about the estate taxes is it's similar to the secession topic in that most people at first pass think it's a very narrow and very precise
topic,
and you have to kind of know about it, and you have to have understanding about the issues to realize that it links to a lot of material.
That's right.
And
that's right.
If you don't happen to know that, you think it's stupid and you think it's small and you think it's worth one debate and that's it. But if you do understand the topic, you're like, oh, good God, but you can talk about like all of these
things.
And
I mean,
it's a very rewarding, bottomless area of research. Yeah. So
the thing is this, again, though, it's the other thing is, to my understanding, and I'm saying this again as the AP US Gov guy, I believe that this whole discussion about the staggered term limits is a very new thing. Like, I feel like it was briefly discussed around the Federalist Papers, and then people were just like, okay, it's a life term. And only fairly recently, when we've had this deadlock, this mentality, it's actually a fast, this is just to digress for a moment. When I taught this past year, this is my first year teaching this class, we did this like sort of like simulation of the Robert Bork hearings. And what was fascinating to me was, and these were top students of Bronx Science who I realized that even just from casual reading, these kids actually thought that you had to have 4-4-1 on the Supreme Court. In other words, somehow it's so ingrained into the American consciousness now that they're the 4 liberals, the 4 conservatives, and the swing vote, that there were kids in my class who just thought that was what the Supreme Court was supposed to be, which of course is absurd, but sort of speaks, I guess, to why the life term thing has come up again, because people realize that the court has become so rigid and polarized in a way. So it is a fascinating topic. I don't see how it runs for 2 months.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely
March, April, or nationals.
It's a great topic for
this would be an amazing nationals topic.
Yeah.
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 I think I gave it a high rating, I think, but I think it is in light of not being debated too much, because you just go so far with it once you've done it. But I think it is a good subject for kids to learn about and to think about.
So, I like the idea of this being your people's votes for nationals. Mm.
Okay. Well, that's 3, and we pretty much filled up a show.
The next one's a doozy, so, yeah.
The next one,
It's a good one, but it's a long
it'll,
one.
It'll be fun to talk about, but I don't think we'll disagree on it.
No.
So, okay, we'll wrap it up. Next time we'll try to get Mr. Beats to join us. He's out doing his VBI for the next couple of weeks, so we should be able to get him when he wants to run away from all those screaming children, and we'll get him to join us. He would have joined us tonight, but he didn't bring his equipment with him to the campus, so he wasn't able to do it. So, okay. So, that's it. So, gentlemen, good night.
Good night.
Good night.